The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the New York Police Department has been found guilty of using aggressive disorder control methods and adding to tension during massive protests. The demonstrations broke out after the killing of a black man, George Floyd, in Minneapolis. While the Department of Investigation has found systemic problems in planning and response by the NYPD. Now, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio was also criticized for his response during the spring protest. So what does it all mean, and will it bring about a change? Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate. We're going to start it all off crossing over to Washington, D.C., and let's talk to correspondent Colin Campbell. Colin, thanks so much for being with us. Well, Colin, break it down for us. Exactly what does it mean?
Well, it looks like what happened here is that the mayor, Bill de Blasio, commissioned a report asking for how police responded to the protests brought upon by the death of George Floyd, the man who was killed in Minneapolis after a white police officer kneeled on his neck for more than 8 minutes, leading to his death. And then, of course, we saw the protests happening across the country as many people identified and saw that there were disparities in policing in white and black communities. Now, in New York, where we have these protests, the investigation showed that police used excessive force in the way that they tear gassed people, in the way that they arrested people, in the way that they responded to these protesters, at some points driving police cars into the crowd. And if we remember, in Charlottesville, Virginia, when there were protests there, that is how one woman died. Ms. Byer died by a white supremacist driving his car into the crowd, killing someone. So the implications there are very great, that police could have killed people as they were trying to, quote unquote, do their jobs. And I think what this shows is that there is a serious issue when it comes to policing protests, policing communities of color. This is a long-standing issue, not something that has been an issue or a problem in the past decade or 2 decades or 3 decades. It's been more hundreds of years since the inception of the United States of America. And what we're showing is that even in the 21st century, there are still problems with this that need to be resolved.
All right, thanks so much for that update. That's Colin Campbell out of Washington, D.C. I'd like to welcome our next guest to the program. Out of Philadelphia, social justice activist Yanni Narago. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, what do you make of this investigation overall?
You know, it's interesting, and I appreciate the comments of my colleague who was speaking before me, because this has been an ongoing issue. And one of the things that people don't look at often is the history of police. And there are a few histories. There's a history that recognizes that before there was a police patrol, there was a patrol of individuals who were a slave catching patrol, and the connection between those is easily discerned, even especially if you just look at the badges. The sheriff's badge, which is a star badge in the U.S., the U.S. sheriff, is the same badge. It looks the same as the badge that slave patrol individuals used to wear, and so. In both of those instances, the purpose of the police was to protect property. At that time, people were considered the property of those who were wealthy. And this entire police district in the U.S. is really geared to protect the property of the wealthy, whether it's people property and their ability to exploit and use people and exploit people's labor, or it's actual, like, physical property, which is demonstrated when you look at the example of Breonna Taylor, when there was no indictment for her murder, but there was indictment for the bullets that missed her body and hit the property around her. One of the things that they talked about in this instance with New York, and they've been talking about this in a lot of instances across the country recently, is this need for reform. And there are a lot of these people who are leaders who are saying, we've got to do better, we've got to do some sort of reform. And I think the reason that you're beginning to hear this, what's the new narrative that's coming out, there was a recent murder in Philadelphia of a young man, Walter Wallace, who was having a mental health episode and needed support. and was murdered. And what was and what the narrative was of the police at that time was that those individual officers were not trained properly for that situation. And that's the same thing that they're saying now with the investigation, that these officers were not trained.
Okay, stay with me, Yanni. We're going to continue this discussion, but let me get my next guest in on this. I'd like to welcome out of Newark, co-editor of Anticonquista, Nicholas Ayala. Thank you so much for being with us. You heard our guest there in Philly and basically saying that perhaps the narrative is changing. Now they're talking about as far as the techniques that have been used and why it's being used. Your take on this, I mean, we have this investigation out of New York talking about and criticizing some of the techniques that were used. It's not the first time that we've had investigations that have actually found some type of abuse by police. Is it going to make a difference this time around? Do you think that changes would be implemented?
Well, one thing that's interesting about the report that came out of New York is, like the previous guest was saying for me, a lot of it comes down to they put the blame on a lack of training, that the officers were ill-prepared to deal with such huge crowds. But in New York, we saw one of the things we saw in the summer was police officers running over people with carts. I'm sorry, but that doesn't come down to a lack of training. That comes down to what kind of person you are and morality. And I think that these reforms that are being pushed by the New York Police Department and the mayor are really just more excuses to try to distract from the real evils that exist within the New York Police Department and really the whole U.S. Police Department. And, you know, these reforms, again, they're not going to, like you said, we've seen them try to push reforms over and over again. When Obama was president, we saw that with the death of Trayvon Martin, there were many pushes for reforms, and there were reforms. They added body cameras onto police officers, and yet 4 years later, we're still having this problem. So I don't think these reforms are really going to achieve much of anything, and they really distract from the bigger issue at hand.
Well, let me turn to Philly. What do you think the bigger issue at hand is, Yana?
One of the things, the point that I wanted to make, which was started to be made also by the person who just spoke right before me, is that there's a move and a push right now to abolish the police and to create new systems that are actually equitable and just in the United States, where people and communities will actually be able to be protected and safe. And I think that this narrative around reforming the police is an actual effort to push back against the real need to remove this unjust force from our communities and replace this force with something that is built actually with care and protection for all at its core, because that's not how these police are. So the police come and they come with weapons. There was recently a video of a woman who was whose apartment was battered into, and she was naked, and they handcuffed her. Nine male police officers walked around with her standing completely naked while they moved around her apartment, which was not even the apartment they were supposed to be going into. The police don't have concern for these communities. Many of the people are not even from our communities. But even when those kinds of adjustments are made, it doesn't transform anything, because at the core of the system, it is an unjust system, it is a violent system, it is an occupying force in communities, predominantly Black communities, communities of color, and poor communities, and that's not going to change. What needs to change is the existence of these forces in our communities.
Right, so let me just jump in here, what you just said, because you're saying basically occupying forces. So if there are any kind of changes, how far would these changes go, and could it get to the crux of the problem if, according to what you're saying, these are occupying forces? So tell me exactly what you're saying here.
So when you have outside individuals, they are not, for the most part, people do not police their own communities. People are policing other communities. So they are not desired in many of these communities, and they come in with weapons, and they impose their force and whatever it is that they feel, because they have the authority of being police officers, because we have systems that will believe police officers no matter what they say, and often even when there's evidence against them that is on video, there's no kind of relief against what it is they might do in our communities. and therefore they are a military might. We have police officers. We have police districts with tanks that show up in our communities. They have weapons that are weapons of war that they use in our local police departments against our communities. That is a warlike force, and they are therefore an occupying force in our communities. They need to be eliminated completely and replaced with something that's good.
Well, what about that, Nicholas? You heard Yane basically talk about the occupying force and saying they bring in weapons of war. I mean, if we recall Ferguson and the situation Mike Brown in that small town, we saw tanks on the street. And yet we know that there's a difference of how the police usually react in mostly minority or mostly black areas, as opposed to, for example, if it was a white affluent area, and how they would respond. So with that being said, and basically that this is systemic racism, how can it be changed, policing in the United States?
Well, I think the reform movement is one step, is one, one path towards the right direction, but, you know, you need something more concrete. You need something that goes a little bit further. The Abolish the Police movement is a very serious movement and a very serious consideration that we need to be looking at, because what that does is it really tackles it looks at the systemic issue of racism. That runs rampant within the police community, but not just racism. It also comes down to classism, because, like we said, or like you just said, the police, they're there to protect private property. They're there to protect, you know, white affluent neighborhoods. And we saw the difference when there were protesters out at the same time with the BLM protesters. There were anti-lockdown protests in May and April. Those protesters who had weapons were treated far better by the police than any of the Black Lives Matter protesters. So the issue really comes down to is the system, the society that the United States has set up. How do you really fix that is by attacking those core beliefs, those core stereotypes and biases that these people come into the force having, right? And in order to do that, again, you need to tackle the issue of systemic racism. That gets down to abolishing the police, because the police are, like the previous speaker said, they are an occupying force. You know, we saw in the last few years, more people in the United States have been killed by the police than U.S. soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan. I would describe that as a war, and that's a war against our own people that's going on right now in this country. And the only way you stop a war is by attacking those soldiers, or by stopping those soldiers who are engaged in that war. In this case, it's the police. So the only way we tackle this issue is by getting rid of them and wholly recreating the system, which is an institution, which is the police institution. It needs to be based more so on rehabilitation rather than punishment. It needs to be based on understanding of the community's needs, particularly poor communities and black and brown communities, because right now, again, as this previous speaker said, we have police forces who are not from these communities going in to try to protect and serve them, but doing the exact opposite. And that's because they don't understand, they don't connect to the community like people who are from there actually would.
Well, Yane, if you've both spoke about abolishing the police and that this movement is growing, tell me about that. What exactly does that mean? Now, Nicholas just pointed out that it means concentrating more on rehabilitation, but how would that work? There are some critics that say that, as a matter of fact, if you abolish the police, it's actually going to be the minority community then that will suffer, because the more affluent communities will have their private guards and protecting them, and it would be basically the poor communities on their own. How would you respond to that?
Well, the thing is that the police serve those same affluent communities. They don't serve our communities. They don't prevent crime. They show up after crime is committed. And they often show up when there's no crime actually being committed, and they commit harm. And so the police does not protect poor and minority communities. The police are a tool of capitalism, and they use racism and they use classism in order to protect the capitalist interest. But really, It's not even that it's a racism that is driving the issue. It's because racism is used. It's the communities that actually serve the best, the capitalist interest the most. And in this moment, the minority communities don't serve capitalist interest that much. And so that's the reason why there are individuals who are protected, even if they're not wealthy, because they align with the capitalist interest. And so what we're working to do in this Abolish the Police movement is to actually go back to where we used to be when black people couldn't call the police when we had problems. We had to handle and take care of our problems ourselves. And we did that by having collective communities that took care of each other. So we are building community at the local level. We are building relations at the local level. And we are building responses, and we're building anti-crime realities. Most of the time when there's a lot of crime in these issues is because there's a lack of security, because people are hungry, because people are impoverished, because people are housing insecure. So if we address those issues, we can take the budgets that are in the police departments. We can use those budgets in order to address the issues of security in communities, and that will automatically lower the amount of crime that happens in communities, and then be able to build relations so when people have problems, they can turn to their neighbors, they can turn to individuals who know them, who care about them, who know their histories, and those people can help them solve those problems. And we have found through examples, through models, through statistics, that the programs that actually function like that have a much better violence prevention rate than the actual police department's programming. So there's already evidence that this type of a shift is actually beneficial to poor and minority communities.
What about that, Nicholas? How likely will it happen as far as the powers that be when you're living in a capitalist system, and part of capitalism is actually having that lower level want to be used as workers to oppress and basically, I mean, that's a very big part of the capitalist system. So with that being said, then how do you transition to something else when you're still existing in that capitalist system?
Well, I mean, part of the strategy when you're first starting is to build what's called dual power. So you want to build, you know, a power structure in the same place in these communities that rivals those institutions of power from the government. And that's really what we're seeing. I think this is what we're seeing on the ground now to some extent, in some places more so than others. You have mutual aid groups who are coming out. You have groups that are coming out to watch ICE and track ICE and make sure and keep immigrant communities safe. You have police watchers, more and more people who are making sure and tracking the police, making sure they're not doing harm in their communities. These are all methods and strategies which begin to build that base of community, which essentially rivals the power of the police. And when you do that, you start no longer needing the police. And again, it should also be important to point out that part of the issue, like we were just talking about, is that economic issue. A lot of the violence, a lot of the problems, the crime that comes from our poor communities stems from the fact that there's poverty, not so much the fact that there's racism. And that poverty is really what we're trying to challenge right now, right? The mutual aid groups, they give out food, they give out clothing. That helps fight the violence more so in our community. That helps fight violence in our communities more so than the police going out there and cracking people's heads with batons or whatever, or shooting people dead, because that's how the police respond. They only know how to respond to violence with violence, whereas here, when we talk about meeting our community needs, we're talking about feeding our communities. We're talking about giving people food, providing shelter. That way that they don't have to be on the street. That way they don't have to struggle to survive. That's the first step, and that's how I see it continuing in the future with this movement.
Yone, the future of this movement, we saw these mass protests taking place for months throughout the country this year. Do you see the dynamics of the demonstrations like we saw this year continuing? And your prognosis for the future, do you see, in general, protests continuing, or do you think things will quiet down?
I don't think things will quiet down, but I don't know that it's going to be protest-oriented. Here in Philadelphia, what a lot of the reorganizers have been doing has been shifting from a protest and mobilizing movement to an organizing movement where we are bringing more and more people together in order to address our own problems and to exact our own solutions. And so I think that there's a change that's not going to be eliminated, right, in the ways that people are thinking and the ways that we want to engage with each other and what we believe we have the right to and what we're willing to fight in order to have for ourselves. But I don't think that protesting, what people are realizing is protesting is one piece, and it's a way that people can come together to express their pain and their rage and to know that they are not alone in those feelings. But that has not changed us from, you know, Walter Wallace was murdered in October, and those protests were happening all summer long. So, you know, there have been so many people, I've had so many comments who have been firebombed, who have had crosses burned in front of their lawns and have been murdered. Organizers have been murdered in Louisville and in Indianapolis and all across the country. People are being arrested by the feds and by different people targeted for their protesting. So we know that protesting alone is not going to do it. We have to build our own power. We have to build our own solutions. And that's where the shift is going, into much larger communal transformation processes. And that's what we'll be seeing as we move into 2021. And that's definitely what's happening in Philadelphia.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us. Out of Philadelphia, social justice activist Jan Nedogo, and out of Newark, co-editor Anticonquista, Nicholas Ayala. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَإِن يُكَذِّبُوكَ فَقَدْ كَذِّبُوكَ قبلهم قوم نوح وعاد وثمود.
And if they deny you, O Muhammad, so before them did the people of Noah and Ad and Thamud deny their prophets.
وقوم إبراهيم وقوم لوط
and the people of Abraham and the people of Lot
وأصحاب مدين وكذب موسى فأمليت للكافرين ثم أخذتهم فكيف كان نكير
And the inhabitants of Madian and Moses was denied So I prolonged enjoyment for the disbelievers. Then I seized them, and how terrible was my reproach.
Dear listeners, after a few sessions talking about the 41st verse of this chapter, we are now going to move on to the next verse. وَإِن يُكَذِّبُوكَ فَقَدْ كَذَّبَتْ قَبْلَهُمْ قَوْمُ نُوحٍ وَعَادٌ وَثَمُودٌ وَقَوْمُ إِبْرَاهِيمَ وَقَوْمُ لُوطٍ And if they belie you, O Prophet, then already before them did the people of Noah and Ad and Thamud belie prophets, and the people of Abraham and the people of Lut. And also, the 44th verse says, وَأَصْحَابُ مَدْيَنَ وَكُذِّبَ مُوسَى فَأَمْلَيْتُ لِلْكَافِرِينَ ثُمَّ أَخَذْتُهُمْ فَكَيْفَ كَانَ نَكِيرٌ And the dwellers of Midian and Moses was also belied, but I gave respite to the disbelievers Then I did seize them, so how severe will be my punishment of them. So, in these verses, the Almighty Allah is telling the Prophet that the rejection of the enemies should not be taken as a barrier for the continuation of the right way. The history of the nations must be used for admonitions and discipline. So, these verses, from one side, console the Holy Prophet and the believers, and on the other side, make the bad end of the disbelievers clear. At first, in order to tell the Prophet ﷺ not to be sad, it says, وَإِن يُكَذِّبُكَ فَقَدْ كَذَّبَتْ قَبْلَهُمْ قَوْمُ نُوحٍ وَعَادٌ وَثَمُودٌ وَقَوْمُ إِبْرَاهِيمٌ وَقَوْمُ لُوطٌ And if they belie you, O Prophet, Then already before them did the people of Noah and Ad and Thamud belie, and the people of Abraham and the people of Lut. Then the Holy Quran continues saying, وَأَصْحَابُ مَدْيَنَ وَكُذِّبَ مُوسَى And the dwellers of Midian وَكُذِّبَ مُوسَى And Moses was also belied. So as these oppositions and rejections did not cause the great prophets to become weakened in their call unto monotheism, unto their call for right and justice, they will clearly not affect your steadfast, pure soul either. In the meanwhile, these blind-hearted disbelievers should not imagine that they can continue their shameful programs forever. As the Holy Quran implies, Allah did respite the rejectors only in order that they would have enough time to be examined and the argument be completed unto them. While they were enjoying blessings of Allah abundantly, they were being examined and the argument was completed for them. They were seized by the divine punishment when they were in negligence.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly The Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
وَإِلَى السَّمَاءِ
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The verse continues implying that you saw how severely Allah rejected their evil deeds and showed them the ugliness of their actions. So you shouldn't be sad, O Prophet. He took those blessings from them and gave them misery and wretchedness. He subhanahu wa ta'ala seized their life and gave them death instead. So how will be the punishment which is unknown and ambiguous to them, and they cannot understand its depth? That's why the verse says, فَأَمْلَيْتُ لِلْكَافِرِينَ ثُمَّ أَخَذْتُهُمْ فَكَيْفَ كَانَ نَكِيرٌ. I gave respite to the disbelievers, and then I did seize them. So how severe will be my punishment of them? So the Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is telling the Prophet that the history of the nations will be repeated, and the history must be used for admonition. The rejections of the enemies shouldn't be counted as a barrier, and you shouldn't be afraid of the disbelievers, since you have Almighty Allah on your support. Also, it has been the tradition, and it has been one of the sunan of the Almighty Allah to send the holy prophets down the earth. And another fixed thing that has existed on the ground is the Almighty Allah giving some time, actually, as the verse says, أَمْلَيْتُ لِلْكَافِرِينَ, giving respite to the disbelievers and to the wrongdoers. But this respite, this time, is not of the good kind, since it says right after it, ثُمَّ أَخَذْتُهُمْ فَكَيْفَ كَانَ نَكِيرٌ. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us with the interpretation of these three verses. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the World with Reporters.
In a rare case, the second in Yemen in the past 3 years, a pair of conjoined twins were born in a Sabain hospital in Yemeni capital Sana'a. The two children are in critical condition and need to be treated outside the country, which is impossible due to the continued siege and the closure of Sana'a airport to the Yemenis.
This is a tragedy that children in Yemen suffer as a result of aggression, blockade, and the use of internationally prohibited weapons, as well as malnutrition. In the case of the Siamese twins and congenital deformations, the biggest problem is that we cannot send them abroad to have surgery, so their lives are at risk.
The director of the Health Bureau called on the United Nations and the World Health Organization to send a plane to transport the two children or to send a medical team to conduct the surgery inside Yemen, where devastated and under-resourced health services cannot offer any help to these children.
I'm the father of the twins, and their condition is critical, and they need to receive medical care and surgery outside the country because the health situation in Yemen is collapsing and Sana'a Airport is still closed.
Infants suffer a difficult situation in Yemen, and the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemen health services have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war on the country in 2015.
With the fast approaching of the new year, the Sana'a Airport remains closed to sick children and women, causing the loss of many lives. The airport is open to United Nations airplanes only. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Local elections in Indian-administered Kashmir held in 8 phases have come to an end. The voting process has remained by and large peaceful amid stringent security measures. After the revocation of Kashmir's special status, regional political parties had refused to participate in the electoral process as a sign of protest against India's decision to strip Kashmir of its autonomous status. That resulted in the strengthening of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party in the Muslim-majority region. However, this time, the regional parties formed an alliance to take part in the local elections. Compared to the past, a large number of people came forth to cast their ballots, and many of them told Press TV that their aim is to keep the BJP away from Kashmir's grassroots.
Since the BJP came to power in India, it started taking decisions against minorities. The BJP has taken Kashmir's autonomy, Kashmiris' jobs, and now they are eyeing land. They don't care about the people of Kashmir. We came to cast our votes against those people who only aim to destroy Kashmir's ethnicity in the name of mainstreaming Kashmir.
More and more people in Kashmir have developed skepticism on the overall electoral process after scores of video interviews of the District Development Council or DDC candidates started circulating on social media. A number of candidates have no idea what positions they are running for in the local administration, and even worse, some have no idea what DDC means.
Kashmir, in order for votes to be equally distributed, the Election Commission has accepted nominations from all sorts of people. There is no set pay requisite for candidates. I wonder who they are empowering. How can an uneducated person with no idea of economy, finance and politics seek equal rights and development for me? Basically, they do not need educated people. They want stooges who will implement what the Indian government will decide for us without thinking about people's interests.
This is the first time that DDC elections are being held. Members of the DDC are expected to prepare and approve district plans and expenditure schemes, which will replace the district planning and development boards in all districts across the region. Earlier, district development boards looked after the planning, approval or implementation of centrally sponsored schemes. The result of the 8-phase elections will be announced on December 22nd. Apparently, the elections in Kashmir have paved the way for other electoral processes in the volatile region. However, many say this ballot has made the people of Kashmir politically aware of the fact that New Delhi is trying to thrust such electoral processes in order to create an impression that normalcy has taken hold after it stripped Kashmir of its autonomy, actually without building trust and bridging the gaps. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The Chinese military on Saturday said it had tailed and monitored a U.S. warship as it passed through the Taiwan Strait. The military said the move deliberately raises the temperature of the Taiwan issue. It said the move jeopardizes peace and stability in the strait. The Chinese military also accused the U.S. of using the Taiwan issue as a pawn for what it called selfish strategic purposes. The U.S. Navy, however, said its guided missile destroyer wasn't a routine mission in accordance with international law. China considers Taiwan as part of its own territory and is opposed to the increasing U.S. support for the island. Last week, the U.S. approved a new major arms sales to Taiwan in a deal worth $280 million. The package is the sixth this year and includes advanced military communications equipment. Washington says the sale aims to improve the security of Taiwan. But some analysts believe the U.S. seeks to push back against China.
The United States doesn't want to create a war over Taiwan, but is trying to push the envelope, is trying to, without breaking the one-China policy, is selling more and more arms to Taiwan, as I said, as part of the pushback against China.
Tensions have been simmering between the U.S. and China over other issues as well, from trade to the coronavirus pandemic and political developments in Hong Kong. The U.S. has also prepared a so-called entity list that mainly hits key Chinese industries over what Washington calls ties to China's military. On Thursday, the Pentagon said U.S. warships would be more assertive in responding to what it described as violations of international law. It accused China of being the most pressing long-term strategic threat. In response, China said it seeks no conflict with the U.S. and wants mutual respect and cooperation leading to a win-win outcome.
We hope that the U.S. side will take a rational and objective view of China's development of its national defense and armed forces, work with China to focus on cooperation, manage differences, and bring the China-U.S. relationship back to the right track.
The souring ties between China and the U.S. come in the wake of President Donald Trump's America First policy. With the incoming U.S. President Joe Biden set to take office on January 20th, it remains to be seen how the currently toxic relationship between the world's two biggest economies will look like. Will the new U.S. president stick to Trump's policy tools and continue the frictions? Will he try to de-escalate the tensions, or will he take a more aggressive anti-China approach?
Russian President Vladimir Putin held his annual press conference. This year it was held in a new format, video conferencing, because of pandemic.
The end of the year Q&A session is a rare chance to get President Putin to answer important issues and draw attention to the country's problems. It has long become one of the biggest media events in the country, broadcasted live on main news channels and radio stations in Russia for the whole duration.
Speaking about the new START arms control treaty between Washington and Moscow, Putin accused the U.S. of starting a new arms race. Putin reiterated his call urging Washington to extend the new START arms control treaty for 1 year.
Now there's a threat that strategic arms reduction treaty is terminated. This would mean that there are no more restrictions on the arms race. None at all. We have called and continue to call on our Western partners to extend this treaty for at least a year. During this year, we would have substantive talks, as diplomats say, on what to do next and how to live on.
Putin said he believed U.S. President-elect Joe Biden is open to dialogue on the issue, but added Russia needs some reaction from the U.S.
That it is the last point that connects the Russian Federation with the United States on strategic issues, because all other treaties and agreements signed by Soviet Union, Russian Federation and the United States were dismissed, were destroyed by administration of Trump. Now we are entering a new period of development in American policy. That's why we hope that previous all agreements and treaties will be respected.
The new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, also known as START, is the last remaining agreement that maintains a nuclear balance between the two countries. Putin also said that the unfounded poisoning scenario of opposition politician Alexei Navalny was in fact part of the U.S.-backed plot repeated by media to try to discredit the Russian leader. He stressed that Navalny was not important enough to be a target. Navalny, 44, was taken ill on a domestic flight on August 20. He was later transported to the German capital. German doctors, however, claimed Navalny had been poisoned with a substance from the group of cholinesterase inhibitors. Since then, Germany and other Western governments have been attacking Russia with accusations that it poisoned Navalny. Moscow has repeatedly and strongly rejected the allegation. Marina Kortanova, Moscow.
Before entering his latest and perhaps last round of negotiations with UK counterparts, the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, addressed the European Parliament early on Friday morning.
Nous sommes à un moment de vérité.
It is the moment of truth.
Il nous reste...
We have very little time remaining, just a few hours to work through these negotiations in a useful fashion if we want this agreement to enter into force on the 1st of January.
There are less than 2 weeks to go before Britain might crash out of the Brexit transition period without a crucial EU trade deal.
Shameful UK government strategy.
Some EU lawmakers are in no doubt as to which side is to blame for the deadlock.
The UK government is taking endless time to realise that some illusions of Brexit simply cannot be delivered.
Many legislators claim the UK faces financial ruin if Boris Johnson's government fails to reach an agreement with the EU.
Meanwhile, the Scottish National Party is waiting in the wings to call a second independence referendum that could very well see the breakup of the United Kingdom.
It has been pointed out that long delays can already be witnessed at EU-UK border crossings.
Dear British friends, is this what you voted for? Passport stamps and lorry queues? This moment is a victory for Europe.
But the European Union is in no position to gloat, it has been argued.
The real division isn't between the EU and the UK. It's between the haves and the have-nots. And we start dealing with that or there'll be a lot more Brexits to come.
Deal or no deal, business groups say the EU needs to pursue major structural reforms, especially in the context of Brexit.
There's a mismatch clearly, so we need better mobility. We need to be able to match the supply with the demand for workers across Europe, not just within member states.
Fishing rights remain the major sticking point in the negotiations. One EU lawmaker has reminded Boris Johnson that his closest ally will soon be history. The COVID-19 pandemic is still here, and so he should choose his next moves carefully. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Parliament of Catalonia Friday approved an amnesty bill for the region's jailed leaders and the thousands of pro-independence supporters who were facing legal action for taking part in Catalonia's independence drive. The bill, which upholds amnesty and the right to self-determination as prerequisites to end the conflict, was backed by lawmakers from the three separatist parties who planned to push it through Spain's Congress next March.
Although lawmakers are aware that the bill has no chance of passing the floor of Congress in Madrid, they went on with it. Gerard Artigas, a parliamentary reporter, explains some of the reasons behind their move.
They know the law will not pass because the socialists in Madrid made clear they will not back it. They went on with it nonetheless, thinking that the Spanish Congress might be the right place to raise the debate on amnesty. Besides, they want to bring the bill to Congress in order to force all parties to take a position vis-a-vis amnesty, while at the same time they seek to take advantage of the Congress to sensitize the wider public about the jailed leaders.
Pro-Spanish unity parties in Catalonia's parliament vetoed the bill and dismissed the separatist claim of Spanish state repression in the northeastern region.
To approve the amnesty bill would mean admitting that Spain has been a dictatorship, and nobody buys that. All Western democracies recognize Spain as an equal, with its defects and virtues, but as an equal. Nobody in the international community is going to accept that in Spain there are political prisoners or repression, and therefore there is no room for amnesty.
Over the past 3 years, human rights NGO Amnesty International has repeatedly called on Spain to release two of the nine jailed Catalan leaders who have been sentenced for 9 years for sedition, a crime the NGO described as, quote, vague and against the principle of legality. Gosai Kedri, Barcelona.
The situation for childcare in the United States was already perhaps the worst in the Western world. Only Ireland spends less on its children. The average annual price is higher for childcare than for university tuition, and the cost is second only to a family's rent or mortgage. That was before Corona hit. This year, childcare costs have soared nationwide a back-breaking 60%, according to the Center for American Progress. But it has doubled or almost tripled in big cities. Plenty of households weren't prepared for any childcare costs at all. but many free public schools have been shuttered for months due to Corona. The huge price increase has caused parents to quit their jobs just to watch their children and produced financial anxiety for even moderately comfortable households.
Staying home shouldn't be an oath of poverty. You know, if you can afford private childcare, great. Let's have public childcare that's decent and affordable and facilitates people and protects families, because, you know, childcare should be a right.
The federal government's only household relief package this year gave qualified parents just $500 per child. That covers just a few weeks of childcare. It's not just financial. The upending of supervision programs for minors is being called a huge setback in early development and child safety. In cities like Chicago, a minor is 25 times more likely to die from murder than from coronavirus, but closed schools can't provide any structure, and so 2020 has seen a huge increase in juvenile violence and crime.
It's been very stressful on children, and there's been a lot of fallout. I think there's a lot of fallout with a lot of drug therapies being used at younger and younger ages for children. I wonder how that would be if we had better child care and more child care. There's more young people, depression, suicide, and I wonder again how much of this is a result of lack of affordable child care.
Despite the increased cost for parents, the scientific data, and the negative effect on child learning, many in the U.S. want schools to remain closed until autumn 2021. The average parents can only wonder how they'll be able to foot that bill. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
As thousands of people continue to die each and every day in the EU from COVID-19, a great deal of focus is on the issue of vaccines. The subject has just been debated by EU lawmakers.
Le campagne vaccinali sono
Inoculation campaigns began in the UK, the US, Russia and China. The European Union, what was it doing? It's been behind schedule again, waiting for some sort of green light from the European Medicines Agency. Same thing with managing the pandemic. The EU worked very badly. Nations had to go it alone.
We are told that the European Medicines Agency, which authorizes vaccines on behalf of the 27-nation EU, will give the go-ahead next week for use of the Pfizer-BioNTech jab. The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted that vaccination will start across the EU on December 27th, 28th and 29th. However, there is concern that nations are not prepared. Apparently, many EU countries have not yet submitted their vaccination plans to the Commission. EU authorities insist the process cannot be rushed.
Safety of vaccines.
We have been speaking to citizens.
We have to take care of getting this herd immunity through the vaccine. So it is key for our Western states to get there now, given that we're almost in the third wave, I think.
I just think that I will not get the vaccines for myself too early. I just want to wait a little bit to see if there are the secondary effects, bad effects on people.
Lawmakers are expressing outrage that the European Commission is resisting calls to share the formula of proven vaccines with developing nations on the basis that it would stifle investment into vaccine research.
I urge the Commission to rethink their position and to show the world that saving lives is more important than saving an outdated model of intellectual property rights. Access to medicine for all is a human right.
On the economic front, all sides agree that developing a successful vaccine strategy is crucial to preventing the EU from being rendered completely bankrupt. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
House of Kabul is a small but cozy coffee shop in downtown Tehran. As its name suggests, it's owned and operated by Afghan migrants. The cafe hosted reporters along with officials from the Iranian High Council for Human Rights for a friendly gathering to mark the International Migrants Day. It was a chance to both have a cup of tasty Afghan tea called Ghaymaq and talk about the issues facing Afghan refugees in Iran.
I came with my family to Iran 13 years ago and started hospitality management here.
I didn't face serious problems during my study in Iran, but now that I want to start a business, I have to go through a complicated process to acquire the needed licenses.
This was also the case for the owner of the House of Kabul Cafe, who moved to Iran 35 years ago and studied fine arts, and then ran this cafe as a family business. His son, Ali Akbar, who works as a barista here, says it was not an easy job to launch this coffee shop.
It took my father several years to get the license to run this cafe. It was because none of our family members have related degrees. But I'm so happy that we finally launched it, and we have many customers who enjoy our Afghan traditional drinks and foods.
More than 3 million Afghans live in Iran. Around 1 million of them are refugees who have fled the ongoing conflict driven by terrorism and the presence of foreign troops in their country. Together with some 3,000 Iraqi refugees, they made Iran the 8th largest refugee hosting country in the world in 2019. The head of Iran's High Council for Human Rights did not ignore the issues migrants face in Iran and said he was here to listen to their concerns.
A significant portion of the Afghan refugees in Iran have entered the country illegally, and this creates some problems, especially with regards to their children's education. But during the past years and following a decree issued by our leader, all Afghan immigrants have access to free education. Today, our Afghan brothers and sisters in Iran are active in a variety of fields, and today I had the chance to speak to some of their elites and listen to their concerns.
Based on the United Nations 2019 estimates, there are around 272 million migrants in the world. That's 3.5% of the global population. Each year on December 18th, the International Migrants Day is marked to highlight the contributions made by the migrant communities and to address the challenges they face. This year, the occasion focuses on the issue of social cohesion as one of the major concerns of each migrant.
Afghan migrants here say dignity and respect are the main things each migrant needs to integrate into a new society. This gains even more significance when they try to restart their lives in a place other than their home country, where they seek to build new lives away from conflict and disaster. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam, Mir Baghiri, about the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Please stay tuned.